We've been dealing with Isaiah 40 to 55, two sections, 40 to 48, and then there's a break, and then there's a different mood in 49 to 55, but they all belong to that exilic period. We're now coming, the disciples, some of them the people themselves, the temple singers or the prophet preachers or whatever word you're going to use to talk about these poets, these inspired poets, some of them would have come back with the exiles. And so they continued their mission in Judah, in Jerusalem. But for some of them, there'd be the next generation coming back. So you've got a very close connection between the section we've done and the section we're about to begin, which is 56 to 66, the final section of the Isaiah scroll, some of which is post, what's all post-exilic, but some of it is a cleaning up of the earlier stuff as well. So we're back in, there's a map, we're back in this tiny little part of the Persian Empire called Judah. Notice it doesn't go to the coast, it's just Jerusalem and then Hebron and a few little places around there, and a lot of the what used to be Judah is now the Edomites, the Idumea, we will be called later. Herod was one of those. The group that the Edom had moved in there in the meantime, and they stayed there. And Samaria was under a governor, and it's quite likely that Judah was under the governor of Samaria for a while, so they're not quite sure of that. So you're dealing with a much smaller little place, basically Jerusalem and the hinterland of Jerusalem. And that's where this material comes from. So in this first half, I'm actually going to do one verse. Now there's a record for you. We're going to do chapter 56, verse 1 for the first half hour. So I'm going to be introducing the whole material to you first, then looking at that first verse, which has the key theme of the whole lot, and then afterwards we'll do some more. With chapter 56, we're moving then into a different world. The school of prophet preachers who composed Isaiah 40 to 55 wrote during the time of the Babylonian exile. They kept insisting, as you know now, that Yahweh would bring the exile to an end and he would restore Judah and Jerusalem. In the early part of their ministry, chapters 40 to 48, they directed the people's hopes towards the Persian king Cyrus, whom they described as Yahweh's chosen instrument, even using the word Mashiach, Messiah of him. They were partly right, in that in 539 Cyrus did enter Babylon in triumph, and he continued the policies which they'd been hearing about, I presume, from other places, of letting people return back to their own country, where have their own homeland, their own religion, their own temples, etc. And this allowing included the exiles from Judah. And you find a reference to that in Ezra chapter 6. So a small group of exiles led by Sheshbazzar returned to Judah when they were given permission. A small group, an exploratory group sent from Babylon. And in Ezra, a book written in about the middle of the 5th century, 450, that kind of period, in chapter 1, chapter 5, and in the first book of Chronicles, which belongs to the same body of literature, you'll find reference to that. The foundations of the temple were laid, according to the instructions given them by the Persians, and the work, however, was not continued. So it didn't go far. It appears from chapter 49 to 55, which we did last week, that they lost hope, these people in exile in Cyrus, but they didn't lose hope in Yahweh. They kept faithful to their mission of keeping Yahweh's promise before the attention of the people. And I said to you last week, they came to see that they had the responsibility to be the true Israel. They'd have to be the ones to be the servants of the Lord when the general community weren't doing it. Perhaps they never had much of a hearing. But in the second section, that's 49 to 55, it's clear that they were scoffed at and rejected. However, they continued to trust that Yahweh was indeed speaking through them. Now, Cyrus was killed in battle in 530. His successor, Cambyses, was succeeded in 522, 9 years later, by Darius I. This was an unsettled period in this Babylon and the area, with revolutions breaking out throughout the empire. In the book called the Hebrew Bible, written by Norman Gottwald, I've got the references there, he makes this statement. With the death of Cyrus's successor, Cambyses, that's in other words when Darius I became emperor, a major uprising shook the Persian Empire. As part of an effort to pacify the empire, Darius decided to launch a more serious drive to recolonize Judah as a strategic, military, and political salient on the frontier of troublesome Egypt. So, this was Darius when he took over this troubled area. Egypt, of course, is the big alternative to Assyria, to that part of Iraq area. So, they decided, apparently, to strengthen Jerusalem, because it's the halfway mark, as an outpost as against Egypt. So, in 520, Darius sent Zerubbabel to Jerusalem as the governor. Zerubbabel was the grandson of King Jeconiah, who had been deported from Jerusalem in 597. Look up the first book of Chronicles, chapter 3, you'll find that. With Zerubbabel went Joshua the high priest, and if the historical record from the following century is accurate, and it could be, but it's a 100 and something years later, so it may not be, they led a large contingent of about 40,000 exiles, no longer, as with Sheshbazzar, a small exploratory group. Now a considerable number went back. They went back freely, but they went back. 40,000. Ezra chapter 2 notes that. This is the period of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, who were hoping that Zerubbabel would re-establish the Davidic dynasty, since he was the grandson of the last Davidic king. However, any such possibility of a restoration of the dynasty was dashed when Darius I consolidated his control. So, they're a bit weak, a bit divided, different people wanting to be emperor over in Persia, so it looked a possibility they might have been able to become independent and all that, but it didn't work out. The empire remained stable for a century, partly because there were only three kings throughout the time, all this century. Darius I, for a period of 40 years roughly, Xerxes I, 20 years, and Artaxerxes I for another 40 years. So they had long reigns and stable reign, which meant, of course, ability to keep complete control of the outer provinces, or satrapies, they called them. Now, among the returned exiles, we're still doing the background to our text, were members of a school of exilic prophets, the ones who are responsible for Isaiah 40 to 55. It's to them and those following them that we owe chapters 56 to 66. Section we're about to study. You'll note this as you read your text. They show no interest in a Davidic king. They look to Yahweh to intervene and put things right. So you're getting into eschatological writing a bit, which is always from outside history, there'll be a divine intervention that'll set things right. That's what eschatology basically means. Whereas up till then, the prophets, pre-exilic, were getting the king to change his policies to get things right. Now they've got, who the policies are being organised from Persia, what are they going to be able to do about it? So they think, well, we're just a little tiny group in this big empire, and that'll stay the same under the Greeks, that'll stay the same under the Romans. So you get the birth of a different kind of literature, which is wanting God to break the heavens open and come down and clean things up for us. because we've got no one to do it. As we examine the text, we'll see many themes that are consistent with those of Isaiah 40 to 55 and a number of references to the prophecies found there. I'll give you a couple in a moment. They continue to speak of the breaking in of a new age of salvation. If you compare 62:11-12 with the opening words of Isaiah chapter 40, you'll see that. Isaiah 40 begins, "Comfort, comfort my people. You know, you've done double for your sins and my salvation is at hand," and so on. They continue to speak of the central role of Zion in the promised new age. If you compare 62:1 with 49:14, they see their ministry as servants as a continuing of the ministry of the servants of the exile. And there's a few references there, and we'll meet them as we go along. For the moment, a comparison of the following text will help to illustrate the close connection between the third part of the Isaiah scroll and the second part, which is Isaiah 40 to 55. So I'll read to you in red or reddish colour there is the part we're about to study, the post-exilic writings, and in the blue are the writings from the exile, and you'll see the similarity, I'm sure. Isaiah 62:11, read from the part we're going to study, reads, "See, your salvation comes, his reward is with him, his recompense before him." Then you look back to chapter 40, written in the exile, chapter 10. "See, Yahweh God comes with might. His arm rules for him. His reward is with him and his recompense before him." It's not a quote. They're not intending to quote. But you hear the echo, don't you? So, and there are many like that. Here's another comparison from chapter 60, verse 9, which is in the post-exilic writing, back to chapter 55, verse 5, which is in the exilic writing. And look at them. Chapter 60 reads, "The coastlands shall wait for me, for the name of Yahweh your God, and for the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you." Compare that with the exilic writing in chapter 55. "You shall call nations that you do not know, and nations that do not know you will run to you because of Yahweh your God, the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you." We'll note further parallels as we continue. So the third part of the Isaiah scroll, which is 56 to 66, focuses on the following things. The internal wranglings of the community back in Jerusalem. It was a messy time. All these people coming back from exile, and there's the people at home who've taken the land, by the way, because they thought they'd never come back. And people who come home want their land back, reasonably. People have already been there for 60 years, resent that with reason. And so there's all kinds of points of view. There's the priests coming back and determined to have the cult really clear. People who thought that the reason for the exile, for destruction of Jerusalem and the exile was God's punishment because they weren't keeping the Torah absolutely. Can't you see how the absolutists in the community would say, right, we're going to do everything by the book. There's going to be no hanky-panky, no slipping around, no using of these, no, you know, thinking, oh, it's okay, we can know, we're going to be right according to the book. Which meant they had to get rid of their Moabite wives. If they had Moabite wives, they had to be really rigid. The people who were sick, punished by God, couldn't be allowed into the assembly. Do you see what's happening? A narrower view is coming that's perfectly pure. If you want to belong to a perfectly pure community, leave the Catholic Church, will you? Because you'll find, what I mean is that we're in it. So, but there can be purists, can't there? Puritans, I don't want to use that word in a historical sense, who want to belong to a community that's absolutely, well, that's happening back there, and these people don't belong to that group, so it's difficult. The internal wranglings of the community back in Jerusalem. These chapters don't have a single author. The exhortations and criticisms come from a minority movement in Jerusalem that is discontent with the way things are working out since the erection of the second temple in 516. And the material of these chapters we're about to read, 56 to 66, seems to range from the return from exile right through till the middle of the 5th century, the time of Ezra. During this period, Judah was under the governor appointed from Susa, the capital of the Persian Empire. Now, it's important to note, or remember if you already knew it, that from the Persian point of view, the Second Temple was an instrument of Persian control in Judah. It was under the authority of the governor, not the temple priests. So the church was under the state, which was not a really Israel idea, but was Persian. Keep a bit of law and order in the place. Those who composed these chapters, 56 to 66, have nothing to say about the leadership, including nothing good to say about the leadership, including the temple priesthood. You'll see plenty of that. And they rail against the prevailing religious compromise in the cult and the rampant injustice that is contrary to genuine Yahwism. So in that railing against injustice, they're right on the original Isaiah ben Amos's key theme, the key theme of the exile. And that's what links all this together, is this sense of God being a God of justice. However, they weren't in a position to do much about it, apart from complaining and continuing to point to the will of God as expressed in the Torah and the prophets. They shared the fate of those responsible for Isaiah 40 to 55 in that they were a persecuted and shunned minority. They were whatever. Things changed with the coming of Ezra, who was a priest sent over from Babylon, from the Persian rule, over to, he probably brought the Torah back with him, and the complete Torah, which was worked on mainly back in Babylon, and also a bit in Jerusalem, but it seems the main intellectual work was going on in Babylon, and he brought it back with them, and when he brought it back, they heard some of it for the first time, and that's when Judaism really gets going. In the middle of the 5th century, what we call Judaism. But that's another story which was not a topic of our lectures in this series. Besides the continuing inspiration provided by the prophet preachers of Isaiah 40 to 55, Besides the continuing inspiration provided by the prophet preachers of Isaiah 40 to 55, the authors of Isaiah 56 to 66, our present section, were strongly influenced by the post-exilic members of the Deuteronomic school. They're all in it together. They're all, well, whether they're together or not, but they're all debating in really good Jewish style. They're in there arguing about the text, trying to get the best meaning and compromising and thinking and different points of view put in. So you can see, if you've got the eyes to see it, there's not only a second Isaiah influence, but there's also influence from the Deuteronomic school in this material. There are similarities in homiletic style, though this may be because of the growing significance of the synagogues, which provided an ambience for presenting one's ideas in an oratorical style appropriate for preaching in a synagogue. Deuteronomic influence is seen especially in the religious concerns, notably their stress on the necessity of fidelity to the Torah, which is a very strong Deuteronomic. And by the Deuteronomic, I mean the author is Deuteronomy and the massive part of the Old Testament. And the authors of all those texts, Joshua, Judges, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, are all from the one school, the Deuteronomic school, the history writers, if you could call it that, history inverted commas. So it's a big influence in the building up of the Bible. The salvation hopes of Deutero-Isaiah, or of the prophet preachers of the exile, however, were not realised. So if you go back to those hopes that we saw in that material the last couple of weeks, they weren't realised. Economic hardship continues. In Judah is really very poor. The city has been destroyed. They haven't got the means or the trade or the power or probably even the expertise, because a lot of it stayed back in Babylon, to get the thing moving well. So it was a time of depression, really. Recession, anyhow. Economic hardship, you'll see that in 60 and 62. Insecurity in political life, you'll see when we read the texts next week and some this week. There's ruin and devastation around, clearly, if you read the text there. And the burden of the continuing shame of their who they are, just as a little outpost from the Persian Empire, not the great nation that's God-chosen people, and they've only got a little tiny Judah, and they should have the whole of the promised land. All of that stuff is playing on. The disciples of 2nd Isaiah blamed the community, and these are the things you'll find them blaming them for. I'm only giving you a bit of a preview to get your head ready to enjoy it next week and this week. They're failing to keep the Sabbath. Well, they weren't anti-law people. That's one thing they come up with. They failed to observe the dietary laws. They had a false attitude to fasting. Beautiful chapter. We'll do it next week. Immorality and idolatry in the community. Sinfulness, speaking generally. Opposition of those in authority to proper behaviour and proper life of the community. And those who are especially to blame are those responsible for the cult. And they have a go at them all the way through. So as a priest, I find it uncomfortable reading. Do I have to keep... How I did this, I don't know. I must have had a very bad night. However, they continued the proclamation of salvation. This salvation would be a historical one in history, though chapter 60, 19 to 20, and chapter 65, 16 to 25 speak in more transcendent terms, more eschatological terms. The salvation would affect the Gentiles. They retained the missionary outreach of the disciples of Isaiah in the exile. So that was good. Whereas the others were narrowing it down to just us and excluding everyone who wasn't one of us. They've still got this dream of carrying out the dream given to Isaiah, to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, etc. Cult worship has a place in the promised state, though it's not stressed the way others are stressing it at the time. And they kept promising God would come soon and directly intervene in their life. These final chapters of the Isaiah scroll have a special interest for Christians because of the way they were appealed to in the early years of the development of Jewish Christianity. Just as the authors in post-exilic Judah saw themselves as the ones who were faithful to the life and mission confided to Israel by Yahweh, and you can think of Paul as an outstanding example, and they continued to point out the failures of the majority, so the Jews who followed Jesus saw themselves as the ones who were being faithful to their Jewish traditions, I meant Paul there, of course, by following the revelation they received through Jesus, the Messiah, whom they believed was sent by Yahweh to bring to fulfillment the revelation contained in the Torah and the sayings of the prophets. So that's where the new Jewish Christian community, Paul, Barnabas, Stephen, you can add quite a few names, but any of those, that smallish group who got the message of Jesus and saw it as the completion or fulfillment of Judaism and learned that being faithful to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob and David and the rest of it and all the prophets was to be a disciple of Jesus who showed how to live Judaism perfectly. That's the point. So and also break free from the legalism of the kosher food and sacrifices of the temple and circumcision and that and open up to the good God-fearers or the Gentile people generally, everyone is welcomed into this mission of that God gave to Abraham and gave to the Jewish people. So to carry out their mission without making people Jews. So it was a marvellous thing, and that's why Christianity is the marvel that it is. But they were the majority didn't accept it from them, weren't happy with it. I suppose majority never are happy with change. I don't know. So they identified very closely with the experience of these returned exiles who were similarly saying, hey, we've got a mission to the world. Stop all this inner looking at the problems of the church. Let's think of the world and what we're supposed to do there. They saw themselves as faithfully living out the mission given by God to Abraham, their father in faith. Just as those, this concludes my introduction part, just as those responsible for Isaiah 56 to 66 kept appealing to the majority to be converted, so the authors of the New Testament, Paul especially, kept reaching out to their co-religionists to re-examine their traditions in the light of Jesus' life and Jesus' teaching. Like the, quote, suffering servant, Jesus was scoffed at and rejected by the Jewish authorities. But again, like the suffering servant, in his patience, obedience, prayer, and love, Jesus revealed who God really is. And he opened Judaism up to the surrounding world, sending his disciples out to the nations to bring about the reign of God promised in the scriptures and to take the blessing given to Israel to the whole world, as Yahweh had promised Abraham in the beginning.